think this was just a random act of violence. It was two things. One is a very deranged individual who I understand long before he was dishonorably discharged from the United States military was demonstrating some mental illness challenges. But also there, I think, was a particular reason why this particular location was targeted.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott this morning on Good Morning America speaking about yesterday's shooting at a small church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. 26 people were killed, around half of them children. The shooter, who later died, was Devin Kelly. He had a history of domestic abuse. In 2012, he was court-martialed for assaulting his wife and child. 2 years later, he was discharged from the Air Force for bad conduct. He had also sent threatening texts to his mother-in-law, who attended that church. She was not there yesterday. And his background is not unique. In more than half of mass shootings, one of the victims was an intimate partner or relative of the shooter. Las Vegas gunman Stephen Paddock was notorious for verbally abusing his girlfriend in public. And before Omar Mateen opened fire on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando last year, his ex-wife said that he beat her repeatedly. His second wife said he was both verbally and physically abusive. The list goes on. Karen Atiyah has been writing about domestic violence and mass shootings for The Washington Post, and she joins us now. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And also, we are joined by UCLA law professor and gun violence expert Adam Winkler. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you, too. Well, Karen, let's begin with you. Let's talk about some of these cases where the shooter had a history of domestic violence. Is it common in, as we said, in most mass shootings, there is some knowledge of the victim and the perpetrator know each other. What is the story of domestic violence and these mass shootings?
Yeah, so, you know, and you cited this in your intro, according to advocacy groups, Every Town for Gun Safety, they have a report that says, you know, around 54% of mass shootings have involved a partner or a family member being killed. And, you know, we have James Fields, you know, even in Charlottesville, who rammed a car into a crowd of protesters. He reportedly hit his mother, threatened to beat her. James Hodkinson, who shot at Steve Scalise, who was arrested for domestic battery. This is, you know, not to say that every man who's convicted or accused of domestic violence is going to go on and cause carnage and go on a mass rampage in public. And it's not to say that every man who has committed an act of mass violence or terrorism has had this in their background, domestic violence in their background, but it does show that there is a certain pattern, that there is a correlation that, in a sense, women and children, violence against women and children can act as a sort of canary in the coal mine, so to speak, when we're looking for how motives or patterns or just even factors that could potentially predict behavior that could cause a public safety concern. So I think really, and what I've been trying to say is, you know, what if we treated domestic violence, violence against women, as more of a public safety threat and as more of, frankly, a national security threat? Mm. After we have shootings or acts of terrorism that people think are committed by immigrants or refugees or Muslims, we have these calls for extreme vetting. We look to method or motives of mental illness. But, you know, what if we started treating this as more of a national security issue? What if we started thinking about how to prevent domestic abusers from getting their hands on guns? That's a very basic, I think, question and a very basic act we can take to help prevent these things.
Yeah. Adam, what about that? Have there been attempts to do that, to try to prevent people who have convictions for domestic violence for getting a hold of guns?
Yes. In fact, there is federal law on the books today that says if you are convicted of a domestic violence misdemeanor or you're currently under a restraining order in a domestic violence case, you're prohibited from purchasing a firearm. We've also seen a number of similar laws passed at the state level. Even in states that are very solid red states, usually beholden to the NRA, taking guns out of the hands of domestic violence perpetrators is one of those things that people across the aisle on guns generally agree on.
But I guess the problem there is whether or not they've been convicted.
Well, there are issues of conviction, but there also is domestic violence restraining orders. But it is true that merely because someone has been accused of a crime does not lead them to lose their constitutional rights as a general matter.
Right. So, Karen, what about that? There are laws, as Adam says. What more would you like?
Right. Well, I mean, at the very least, it's, and we see this. I mean, even the CDC, right, has said that when it comes to leading causes of homicide for women in this country, that a good percentage of women in this country are more at risk from men that they know in their lives. It's the fifth leading cause of homicide for women and girls in this country. I mean, of course, you know, we have these laws in the books, but I think it also speaks to, again, the potential for violence, and especially when there's a gun present in the house. It also speaks to why so many women may be afraid, right, to speak out against their abusers, to leave their abusers. We often hear this quote, right, that from Margaret Atwood, where men are afraid that women will laugh at them and women are afraid that men will kill them. And I think, again, this just speaks to that link between misogyny, right, and violence against women and violence in this country. So I think, again, we would need not just gun legislation, but legislatively, how do we help women in these situations, in these abusive situations, and how do we protect them? How do we help keep them safe? Because if mm-hmm. we keep women in the home safe, we're helping to keep the public safe.
And Adam, this particular shooter, he wasn't allowed to have a license because of his convictions. However, as we heard in the newscast, he did have a private security license. What does that mean?
To be honest with you, I'm not familiar with a private security license.
Okay, so but somehow he was able to obtain guns.
Well, he was able to obtain guns lawfully because there was nothing in the federal background check database that would prohibit him from purchasing a weapon. Mm. He was convicted of, he was discharged from the military, but not dishonorably. If you were dishonorably discharged from the military, then you would be prohibited from purchasing a firearm, and he would not have been able to go to the gun store. However, he received something less than a dishonorable discharge, something called a bad conduct discharge, and the military does not report those into the federal database system. One area of reform we might think about is having the military look more closely at things like bad conduct discharges and where they involve things like domestic violence. Require reporting to the background check system.
All right, I want to play a clip of tape of President Trump and his response to the Texas shooting.
I think that mental health is your problem here. This was based on preliminary reports, very deranged individual, a lot of problems over a long period of time. We have a lot of mental health problems in our country, as do other countries. But this isn't a guns situation. I mean, we could go into it, but it's a little bit soon to go into it.
Okay, so Adam, we've heard this mental health response to these kinds of incidents before, and the Trump administration signed a bill in February that blocked the Social Security Administration from reporting mentally impaired recipients to a background check database. How significant is that change?
Well, it was a significant change. One of the bases for being declared ineligible to purchase a firearm is that you've been adjudicated to be mentally ill. And what the Obama administration did was say that in the Social Security process, some people are declared incompetent to be able to manage their own affairs, their financial affairs and whatnot, and have to have someone else do those things for them, manage their accounts. And the Obama administration said, well, if someone can't manage their accounts because they're incompetent, then they shouldn't have access to a gun. That's an adjudication of a kind of mental illness. The Trump administration passed a law that rescinded that rule and allows now Social Security recipients who have been declared too incompetent to manage their own affairs to possess firearms. And while those people aren't likely to be mass shooters, being age and competency issues, they are at a very high risk of suicide.
Mm. Okay, but what about the general argument about mental health issues? I mean, clearly someone who goes and commits an act like this, a mass shooting, is dealing with some altered mental processes. But how do you delineate between that and mental illness?
It's one of the most difficult things to get a handle on in the gun violence prevention movement. We know that if we wait till people are adjudicated to be mentally ill, what gets you disqualified under federal law today, that you're not getting enough of the people. There's many more people who are too dangerous to have a gun for mental illness but have never been adjudicated in such a way. But how do you get at those people? How do you identify them and take away their rights without any kind of court adjudication or due process? It's a very difficult issue.
All right. So I also want to ask you about the ability to sue gun manufacturers. And I'm just wondering why it is. There are plenty of people who are injured but not killed, or there are relatives of the killed who perhaps would want to seek some sort of financial recompense, or and the injured may be dealing with medical bills for the rest of their lives. Why can't they sue gun manufacturers for that?
Well, first of all, there's just a general principle that you're only liable for harms that you are responsible for. And we generally do not hold companies responsible when their products are misused by criminals to commit a crime, whether it be a car or a knife or a gun. What happened was is there were nonetheless a series of lawsuits against gun companies some 20 years ago seeking to hold them responsible in these kinds of situations and to push them to include more safety features and better checks on who they're selling guns to. Congress responded by providing this blanket immunity for gun manufacturers so that they wouldn't face these kinds of lawsuits. Even though the gun companies were not likely to lose these lawsuits as a general matter, the Congress didn't even want them to have to pay the costs of attorney fees.
But what is the argument when you can sue, for example, drug manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, for, you know, bad health outcomes?
Again, I think that's those aren't situations where you're talking about the criminal misuse of the product by a third party. If you are talking about criminal misuse by a third party, then generally those drug companies have nothing to worry about. And indeed, gun manufacturers are still responsible if they produce a defective firearm. If you take a gun and it blows up in your hand, you can still sue the gun company. What you can't do is sue the gun company for the illegal acts of a third party like this shooter in Texas.
All right. Adam Winkler, a law professor at UCLA, author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And Karen Attia is editor of the Global Opinion section of The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why President Trump says calling someone a liar is not defamation, it's protected political speech. This comes in a lawsuit brought by a woman who had accused him of sexual assault. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Harvey Weinstein sexual assault scandal continues to spawn even more scandals involving powerful men in Hollywood, media, politics, elsewhere. The coverage has almost overshadowed a suit against President Donald Trump, a lawsuit over his denials that he sexually assaulted women. Almost overshadowed. Summer Zervas is a former contestant on The Apprentice. She says Trump defamed her when he called her and 11 other women, quote, horrible liars. The women had all accused then-candidate Trump of unwanted touching and kissing. Trump's lawyers argue that the president was merely expressing a political opinion when he called the women liars, and that's protected by the First Amendment. So, it is Monday. That means Jessica Levinson is here. She is a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle. She's here to weigh in on that. What is political speech? How does that differ from regular old speech?
What a world in which allegations that the president may have touched you inappropriately and a defamation suit involving the president has almost been overshadowed. So let's start with basic concepts. The First Amendment protects all speech. It protects against the government intruding on speech, but political speech is what we're most concerned about, because when we decided, yes, we need a protection against expression and speech, what we're generally concerned about is the government saying, you get to say that and you don't get to say this. Is the government picking winners and losers? Mm-hmm. Because the government are the ones who make the laws, and so they're the ones who would be incentivized to say, we'd really rather you not talk about that, but thank you so much. So when we're talking, whenever someone in a court filing says political speech, everyone goes, oh my God, we're so scared. We have to protect political speech. So what this suit talks about is really the matchup between two competing interests. So on the one hand, and we need to keep this straight because I'm going to use the word lying and false statement in mm-hmm. two different scenarios. So on one hand, we have defamation, which protects people from reputational harm. It's basically, I say something to a lot of people, it could really hurt your reputation. It's false. It's really important that it be false, and it actually harms you. Now, if I say something that harms your reputation, but it's true, no defamation suit. Right. You've got to go home. Or if I say something which is my opinion, then no defamation. Because what do we have kind of bumping up against defamation? We have First Amendment protections that I should be able to say whatever I want.
So why doesn't he argue it's just my opinion?
Well, he is. Okay. So there's kind of two arguments, I think, folded in. But both of them are a way of Donald Trump and his lawyers saying, please go home. We don't want this defamation suit to continue. So again, what we have are people who are accusing Donald Trump of unwanted touching, let's say. And then he says, and the operative communication here is from president to about these accusers. And he says, that's an absolute lie. Now, the reason that these defamation suits is important is because it's kind of a backdoor way of litigating whether or not the unwanted touching really occurred. Mm-hmm. Because if it really, he says, you're liars, that is a total fabrication. If it really happened, they're not lying and it's not a total fabrication. But
so will that be part of the lawsuit? Will that be if it gets to that point?
Well, that if it goes forward, and that's the big if here. And this is why actually in the Bill Cosby cases where the statute of limitations had already run on some sexual assault claims, you saw instead what they were bringing was defamation claims where maybe the statute of limitations didn't run. And it was, again, this backdoor way of trying to get at whether or not there was sexual harassment, because, again, when we're talking about you did this, no, I didn't. Well, is the statement true or false?
But is this case different because he represents the government as the president of the United States?
Well, he is the ultimate public figure, but he is not representative of the government, I would argue, in this sense. Now, he made the statements, you're a total liar. And then the question is about the plaintiffs, about the people he made the statement to. And so he's saying, you can't get me for defamation because, one, it was just hyperbole, and two, it was just campaign rhetoric. This is my political speech. This is where the political speech argument comes in. And so everyone understands that elections get hot and heavy, and, you know, I was just saying stuff, basically.
Right. So where are we now with this case?
So we don't know what the judge will determine. If the judge rules in his favor, then it's dismissed. Trump's lawyers have already tried to get this case dismissed before. I think it's important to think about that this case isn't just about Donald Trump and his accusers. This is about what we want to see for defamation law and the First Amendment going forward. And we're seeing more of these cases dealing with people accusing mainly powerful men of sexual harassment. And sometimes these are intertwined with defamation cases. And if courts decide to open up this fairly broad First Amendment exception, that will affect all of these cases going forward, because defamation laws are state-based tort laws that vary by state, but the First Amendment applies in every state. And so part of what we're doing here you know, it's in the news because it's Donald Trump, mm-hmm. and we're looking at his accusers, and we have to ask legal questions like whether or not they're private figures or public figures or limited public figures, because that matters for this case. But what we're also really looking at is defining First Amendment boundaries.
And does Summers or Voss and the others, do they have to prove actual harm? Do they have to say, well, my reputation was harmed in this way and I couldn't get this job or I couldn't get whatever I wanted? So,
as part of the civil tort of defamation, they need to prove damage, yes.
Right. And so are they claiming that?
Yes, they are claiming reputational harm here.
But that led to anything in particular, like a loss of any employment or anything like that?
So for you need to point to some kind of specific reputational injuries. And in this complaint, I can't remember what they mm-hmm. said.
But they have something.
Is. Yes. Okay. And you don't bring this case. Every plaintiff's lawyer will find that there's some
yes,
reason you've
be
been
able
damaged.
To find that. Okay. All right. So let me just quickly turn to another story that's in the news right now. And this is a Supreme Court filing. The Department of Justice accused the ACLU of misconduct in a case involving an undocumented teenager who was seeking an abortion. She finally got the abortion. The ACLU was representing her. Now the DOJ is coming back and accusing the ACLU of some kind of wrongdoing. And what is that?
Right. So the DOJ is saying, ACLU, you said she wasn't going to get the abortion until October 26, I believe it was. But she actually got it on October 25th. And you duped us because you told us there was going to be enough time for us to file an emergency relief in the Supreme Court. And because she had the abortion, the issue is moot. There's nothing to argue about anymore. And so we didn't get to go to the Supreme Court.
And did they dupe them?
I don't know. And I don't think anybody knows except these two parties. The ACLU has said this is total hogwash, or to use an expression from our last segment, you know, this is a total fabrication. Now, I think what's important is that the Department of Justice is asking for two things. One is sanctions against the ACLU, which we could see in a larger sense as the Department of Justice being incredibly aggressive about organizations who are representing certain people and certain rights, undocumented immigrants in this case, and abortion rights. Mm-hmm. But what's also important is that the Department of Justice is saying, and because all of this happened, you really need to wipe off the books the lower court decisions that allowed Jane Doe, this undocumented immigrant, to have her abortion. And I actually think that that's really what this is about. I think the Department of Justice is really angry at the ACLU, but I think they really don't want those cases that said Jane Doe, undocumented immigrant, and it was a nuanced decision, but you can have your abortion under these circumstances. And that represents where the Department of Justice is on this issue of abortion. And so I think it's really about saying we don't want those decisions to stand as precedent.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, and our regular Monday Legal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how Donald Trump has reshaped environmental policy and reimagining the Western.
I thought of it as a reverse Manifest Destiny of sorts. The genre was sort of ripe for being taken over and repurposed.
Author Hernan Diaz talks about his new novel next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. This Wednesday marks 1 year since President Donald Trump's election. In that time, many federal policies have changed. Others have stayed the same. Today, a look at an agency that's seen one of the most dramatic transformations, and that is the Environmental Protection Agency. Trump's EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has rolled back a huge number of Obama-era environmental regulations and even changed the way the EPA operates. Juliet Eilperin is Senior National Affairs Correspondent at The Washington Post, and she's been following this. Hello.
Hi there.
All right. So Trump's EPA under Pruitt has reversed or begun to reverse a large number of rules and regulations, more than 50, I think. So what are some of the key ones?
Well, there are plenty of them, so it's hard to, you know, it's hard to pick them. But I would say at the top of the list is they're really going after a number of rules that the Obama administration put in place to address climate change. And so that includes, for example, limits on greenhouse gases from existing power plants, known as the Clean Power Plan. There are plenty of others that fall in that category, everything including controlling carbon emissions and pollutants that come from trucks that are known as gliders, where you take an old engine and you put it into a new one, or reassessing the fuel standards that apply to cars across the country that were championed by California. Mm-hmm. There are rules on kind of other ways that power plants operate. For example, there had been tighter rules for coal ash, the kind of toxic leftover waste once you combust coal. That's something that the administrator has reversed, as well as limits on the toxins that power plants release into waterways. Then there are kind of other water rules, including a rule called Waters of the U.S., which aim to expand and clarify that the federal government has control over wetlands, streams across the country. And then if you look at pesticides, other chemicals, he's also reversed efforts to impose stricter limits on that. So that's kind of some of the range of things that he's pursued.
And, of course, pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord.
Absolutely. So that, although that was actually the president himself made that announcement, but it was Scott Pruitt at EPA who pushed most vociferously for that exit.
Well, talk a little bit about Scott Pruitt and his power within the administration, because he, before he joined the administration, sued the EPA many times. I mean, he's certainly no fan of the EPA. What is his overall goal? Does he want to basically make it toothless?
He describes it as having a back-to-basics philosophy. And so you're absolutely right. He sued the agency 14 times when he was Oklahoma's attorney general and essentially argued that EPA was overstepping its boundaries on a range of different topics, but essentially that it was, by looking at things like climate change, by imposing stricter rules on farm operations or in terms of protecting endangered species, which is something not done by EPA, but that was another lawsuit he was involved in, you know, that in all these different ways, the federal government was trying to do too much, particularly, and that the states should be in control of many of these key decisions. And so what we have seen is that he has absolutely worked, you know, with actually a pretty skeleton staff of political appointees to make a series of decisions to change the scope of what the EPA is doing and also the way it's operating. He's changing kind of how they get their scientific advice, to what extent career staff are involved in decisions. There are all these ways in which he's really shrinking the kind of key decision makers within the agencies, as well as what the agency is doing.
And speaking of that, you reported that I think on Friday, he appointed more than 60 new advisors to the agency, many of whom come from industry or from state governments.
Right. So these are there are a few different key advisory panels, and they do everything from ensuring that the science that's being done by the EPA is rigorous, that they're looking into the right things for research, to, you know, basically saying, well, if you're going to regulate air pollution or you're going to control chemical exposure, what's the right level? And so, as you mentioned, really what he's done is he looked at a number of different folks who are serving on these panels. Many people, their term was up, and so they could be renewed or you could replace them, and he chose to replace many of them. And he also put a new policy in place which said that if you're a scientist who received grants from the EPA, you would have to choose between continuing to get federal funding or you know, otherwise no longer serve as an advisor. And while, you know, certainly he and others made the argument that this meant you were addressing a conflict of interest issue, the flip side is it meant that many respected scientists who had competed and won EPA grants were therefore effectively barred from serving.
What is the significance of that in terms of environmental policy then, and how we, you know, try to clean up the air and water?
Right. So I think obviously we really have to see what happens in the months to come, because these appointments were just made. And so I think what we need to do is obviously the members of the press and the public will be monitoring kind of what is the criteria that is applied, you know, in the months and few years to come. But certainly what we're seeing is there's no question when you look at some of the appointees that Scott Pruitt chose, many of them are, say, state officials who had been highly critical of the EPA and stricter regulation. This is everyone from Michael Honeycutt, the toxicologist from Texas, who was critical of, you know, EPA's control of chemical exposures, to Tony Cox, a consultant based in Denver, who is now in charge of basically clean air matters and advisories in that sense. And he had questioned some of the smog standard that EPA had settled on a couple of years ago. What you're seeing are folks who have said EPA is too aggressive in its regulation, and so one would imagine, given their both their kind of publishing record and their policy record in the past, they will be suggesting science that would lead to more modest regulation going forward.
So Scott Pruitt doesn't really believe in climate change in the sense that humans are causing it.
He has questioned the extent to which humans are driving recent climate change.
So he's a skeptic. And at the same time, though, on Friday, 13 federal agencies published this report saying that climate change is undeniable and it is caused by humans. And the White House approved that report's release. So how do you explain the contradiction?
Well, what the this was, you're absolutely right, and this report went through several agencies, 13 agencies, including EPA. EPA decided to send it on without commenting and you know, interfering. Essentially, from my conversations with top officials, what Trump appointees, including ones who are skeptical of some of the conclusions, came to decide is that they thought that by editing the report, it would cause more trouble than it was worth, and it was better to allow it to go forward. And then they may choose to scrutinize it in another way afterwards, or, you know, the White House did put out a statement saying the climate is always changing, and, you know, this has happened, and that they're not changing their policies on this. So they really made what I think many people would think is a smart decision, which is not to try to change the findings, but simply argue, as, for example, the George W. Bush administration did, that they're going to pursue policies that are going to focus on economics, and they may not, you know, they may not necessarily heed the findings of this report as they go about doing their regulatory decisions.
Okay, so you, at the top of this interview, laid out some of the things that they've changed in terms of executive order, or what they've done in terms of rule changes at the EPA. How much of that has actually gone into effect, and how much of it is going to be held up with various lawsuits and may not go into effect?
That's a great
soon
question.
Or at any time?
Yeah, I mean, much of this is subject to litigation. So even as they have worked to roll back these rules, what you're seeing is almost every one of these policies is being contested. And one of the interesting things is because the underlying laws, including the Clean Air Act, the National Environmental Policy Review Act, you know, these are laws that are, you know, by any definition, fairly liberal, and give, for example, environmental groups and public health groups plenty of running room to challenge some of these rollbacks. So essentially you're going to see huge legal fights on almost every major policy decision in terms of rulemaking that Scott Pruitt is making. And at the same time, you know, he will be pressing ahead with his push. He said he's focusing on Superfund. He's looking at, you know, some other priorities of his own. And so he will simultaneously be trying to reverse many of these rules while achieving some of his top policy priorities.
Juliet Alperin is Senior National Affairs Correspondent at The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, it is hard to believe, but it has been a year since election night and the reckoning the day after.
Everywhere I've gone today, the feeling is just one of great mourning. I've felt physically ill for the last 2 days.
I'm delighted that Trump won last night. And I think what this says, that it's saying no to the same crony corruption that Clinton represents for a lot of us.
As a woman of color, I think the past 8 years have been filled with obstruction, anger, and I just think Trump tapped into that very well.
And I find it a little amusing to hear people get so worked up and so distraught over Donald Trump win. To me, this is politics as usual, and every election cycle comes and goes, and not much really changes.
We took your calls the day after the election, and we're going to do the same this Wednesday, a year later. How did you feel last year, and how do you feel now? Has Donald Trump changed politics forever? We want to hear from you, and we'll put the call-in number on our Facebook and Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. We'll give it out on Wednesday. So join us, be part of the conversation this Wednesday on Press Play. And coming up, novelist Hernan Diaz talks about his new novel. It's an exploration of the myth of the West. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The new novel called In the Distance follows a young, poor Swedish immigrant on a relentless quest to find his brother. They were separated on their way to America during the second half of the 19th century. Linus ended up in New York, Håkan in San Francisco. And so Håkan decides to walk to New York. It is a dangerous journey. He runs into criminals, zealots, immigrants. It's a story of survival, the American dream. It's a different take on your typical Western. Author Hernan Diaz joins us now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, first of all, I don't think you even want to call it a Western, right?
Well, yes and no. I thought that the Western was a slightly derelict genre that was ripe for being taken over and modeled in my own fashion to say something new about American history.
And the immigrant experience?
And the immigrant experience, of course, which the Western as a genre tends to ignore. Håkan comes from Stockholm without speaking a word of English. For most of the novel, he does not understand what is being said to him and decides to walk across a country that he has no notion of. And the major events in American history of the 19th century, from the Gold Rush to the Civil War and so on and so forth, take place just beyond the horizon. And he just feels the faint ripples of these events as they reach him.
And you don't really know where he is. You kind of feel his own confusion as you're reading the book.
Hopefully. His confusion, yes. His confusion is such, he doesn't even know the world is round, which is a fact he learns very late into the novel. And when he does, he actually fears that he has walked around the globe. That's the extent to which he is lost. And I also try to convey that disorientation in the prose at times as well, hopefully, is confusing enough for the reader, but not too confusing.
No, not at all. But you mean in the dialogue that he doesn't really understand English. And so you don't write those sentences out in pure English. They're kind of confusing, the dialogue.
Yes, that's just a short passage in the novel where the reader gets a taste of what English sounds to him, and I transcribe the gibberish that he hears. But for the most part, he's just trying to pick up the cues from context and his interlocutors and, as best as he can, respond to these situations. But he's guessing, and he's a complete outsider because of this. And because of a second element, which is that he never stops growing throughout the novel toward the end of the book.
Literally growing. He's super tall.
Literally grow. Yes, exactly. Yes. Toward the end of the book, he is a giant almost. within the realm of humanity. There's no magical realism in the book. I would like to clarify that very quickly.
But why did you want to make him a giant?
I just like the idea of a giant walking across the American wilderness, these vast landscapes. There was something about that image that I really, really liked. Secondly, it's a more logical explanation. At a certain point in the book, he's forced to commit a great act of violence, which turns him into an outcast. And I wanted it for him to be impossible to hide in any possible way. And his huge physical size just does that for the book. There's no way he can hide. And that's why he spends most of the novel alone by himself in the plains.
Right. And solitude actually is kind of a character in your novel.
That's great to hear. Yes. And it was perhaps together with violence, which I obviously abhor and was very hard to write, but was demanded in a way by the plot and by the genre itself. But aside from that, solitude was a very hard thing to write. Solitude and the void. It's him alone in a void. Mm. And it was hard to do that without indulging in his psychology or his interiority, which I think would have been cheap shots. So I wanted that vastness around him to, like you said, acquire a voice and be a character.
Well, you definitely feel like you're in the landscape with him. I mean, the writing is so visceral. It's so descriptive. And then I read something about how you wrote this novel, and you said that you didn't really go to these places in the West, which
yes.
like, surprised by, because they seemed so real, the way you described the desert, for example.
Thank you so much. Yes, it was important to me that this was a literary experience, both for me writing it and for the reader. So instead of renting a car and going out there and having sort of a cushy, comfortable experience of my protagonist's ordeals, which seemed a little bit dishonest, I thought I would rely on literature and the American tradition. So I read a lot of travel literature, nature writing, field guides, all from the 19th century. And that is what informs the landscape for the most part. And it's also imagined. I think sometimes research is privileged over imagination, which I feel is the main domain of literature.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking to Hernán Díaz. He's written a new novel called In the Distance, and it's about a Swedish immigrant in the late 19th century trying to find his brother. And he is trying to find his brother. He's in the West and his brother's in the East, and he's trying to get there. Your book is filled with obstacles, of course, on our character's picaresque journey. And
yes.
Lots of interesting characters, including one who's a naturalist, and his name is John Lorimer, and he's a really interesting character. He saves Håkon, then he teaches him basically how to be a doctor, right?
That's right. Lorimer is one of my favorite characters in the book, and it's true, I forgot to mention this, Håkon is a doctor. He has this immense natural talent. He understands the body and its workings, and he's a healer. And a scientist in his own way, intuitive way. And John Lorimer is a character I love because he's based on real people whom I love, like John Muir, the naturalist and activist, who's better known as an activist than as a writer, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. There's definitely an Emersonian nature to John Lorimer. John Lorimer, he's looking for this proto-organism that is some kind of jelly-like creature that he hopes is fossilized in a salt lake in Utah that is the origin of all life on Earth. So,
yeah,
yes,
and
I
he becomes fixated on that despite the enormous risks that he undergoes.
Oh, yes, he almost dies, and they have to eat all the specimens that he has collected along his journeys to survive.
So what are you saying there? Are you saying that that's folly to have these huge ambitions such as this, or is it something that you're saying needs to be embraced and celebrated?
Definitely the latter. Don Quixote was always at the back of my mind while writing this. I didn't reread it for all the obvious reasons, but talk about folly, right?
Mm-hmm.
The novel is full of these people with ambitious dreams that then vanish into the void. One of the main premises of the book, and this explains partly the picaresque nature of it, is whoever Håkon lost in the desert or in the plains never would return.
And he's a pretty passive character. I mean, these things kind of just happen to him.
He is passive until he has to commit this bloody act of violence that I was referring to a little while ago. That is his big moment of agency, and it dooms him forever because he's utterly destroyed. Maybe you're right, he is passive by nature, because the one time he actually steps up, it doesn't go so well for him.
And you were born in Buenos Aires, correct?
That's right.
But grew up in Stockholm, yet your family had to flee during the Dirty War?
Oh, yeah, that's right. We all left when I was 2 years old, when the junta took power in 76. My father was very active politically, and we had to leave the country, actually in a merchant ship. And I grew up in Sweden. We spoke Spanish at home, but I spoke Swedish out in the world. And I think that's actually how I got English. Then we all moved back to Argentina, but I decided that I wanted to live in England, where I moved, and then came to New York almost 20 years ago now. I've been living in New York for the most part of my life.
So you are, in a way, a lot like your character, Håkan.
Yeah, and the book, in a ciphered way, or not, I don't know, depends on the reader, I suppose, but it triangulates Sweden. Obviously, the protagonist is Swedish. Argentina, in a way, because there's a big influence of gaucho literature in the book, and the United States, which is where the book takes place. So to me, all these three traditions are in conversation in the book.
But do you feel as unmoored as Håkan does, as confused by the landscape? Or did you when you first arrived here?
No. Also, I spoke the language, and I had been here a few times as a visitor. No. And oddly enough, after a pretty nomadic life, New York felt very much like home immediately. I feel, rather than having left, I feel that I have arrived.
So it's interesting that he keeps searching for to try to get to New York, and it's, you know, impossible for him
yes.
to get there.
Yes. Yes. Looking for his brother, as he said. And, well, we don't want to give away the ending, do we?
No, we don't. Okay. We won't give away the ending. But it's interesting that he's going east, whereas everyone else is going west. That kind of also does subvert this idea of the Western novel.
Of course. I thought of it as a reverse manifest destiny of sorts. The genre was sort of ripe for being taken over and repurposed, which is what I try to do. And in doing so, I went against a number of conventions, like the one you mentioned, the characters going east instead of west.
Some of the images that you have of the pioneer experience are so bleak. It really made me think, why did anyone do this? What dream were they possibly chasing that could be worth all of the pain and suffering that these poor people went through as they, you know, soldiered
well,
on
I think
westward?
Exactly. But it speaks volumes of the misery they were fleeing from to begin with, I think, right? If it was worth it to embark on this journey, despite all the perils, disease and thirst and so on, one can only imagine what they were fleeing from.
Well, it's been really interesting and great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline.
That's Hernán Díaz. He's the author of a new novel called In the Distance. Okay, Christian Bordahl is here for some listener feedback.
Yes, with some listener feedback. Well, you talked earlier on the program, of course, about yet another terrible mass shooting, this time at a Baptist church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, that's southeast of downtown San Antonio. I think a lot of us have been struck by just, you know, how this keeps happening and the kind of emotions of powerlessness and frustration and sadness and also, unfortunately, a kind of numbness. Brick Wall tweeted in, yes, we are numb, the way we once were inured to dozens of body bags a day arriving back from Vietnam or daily homicides in the 70s and 80s. Michael Van Essen says, we are powerless until we, and I assume he means the Democrats, take control of the House and Senate. But then the opposition will eventually take control again and rescind everything. So that's the kind of back and forth we were talking about earlier as well when it comes to environmental regulations.
Wow, there's a lot of...
there's a lot of stuff going on.
Throwing up one's hands. Okay, I don't think it's that dark out there, but Thank you very much, Christian Bordahl. I'm Madeline Brand. See you tomorrow.